Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine, which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today will be part two in a series, reading The Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan.
Chapter 4. I Wed Lilrin. Lilrin recovered before I could make up my mind to leave her long enough to go down to the stream for water. W.H., what was it, Danely, that terrible noise? And you really killed the Burok? Impossible. H., how did you do it? I showed her the automatic, at which she gazed, fascinated, as I refilled the magazine. Then she looked up at me with her big blue-green eyes. You could have killed me just like at the day I shot at you, she said. And I didn't have sense enough to take that machine thing away from you. Why, yes, I laughed. Of course I could have, but I wouldn't. I broke off, for Lilrin did not join in my laughter. Instead, there was a look of almost tragic solemnity in her eyes. You not only spared my life when I treated you as an enemy, but saved it as well from the terrible Burok. My life no longer belongs to me, but to you to do with as you see fit, Danely. She stood there, straight and slim and brave, her little jaws clenched in the effort to hold back the tears that would not be denied. Then she whirled away from me and broke into uncontrollable sobs. I wanted to comfort her, but I was badly flustered. I knew nothing of Martian customs at all. This girl was as much of a soldier as the men of her clan. Did she mean that I had a right to command her military service, or were her words to be taken literally? Lord, was I expected to claim her as my wife? Lilrin, I said at last, and she swung around toward me with a pathetic little air of submission. Come here and sit down again. You must listen and bear with me while I tell you who I am. She nodded acquiescence, dabbing a bit at her eyes. She would not look at me, and that made it hard to begin. But somehow I managed it. If I only had half a dozen extra arms or legs, or something, I concluded, there'd be some excuse for your believing my story that I just dropped down here from another planet. But here we are, with not as much difference between us as there might be between a man and a girl of two different races on Earth or on Mars, I imagine. It's a wild story, but it's the truth, although I can hardly expect you to believe it. But I do believe it, she said gently. I've seen your spaceship. I went back and found it the day after I took you to our camp. I was curious about you. I found your footsteps coming from the edge of the water, and I swam out. I saw something under the water, and I dived. I did not know what it was, of course, but I knew it must contain the secret of where you came from, and I was worried. But I didn't tell anybody. And I know what's worrying you now, she said, finally looking up at me with grave, serious eyes. It's me. She blushed frankly. But we can't help it, Danely, whether we like it or not. The law is, to him who has saved a life, belongs that life and the service thereof, she quoted. She breathed almost with a sigh. It has been that way among the Tar-Ener for untold ages, since the days when fire rained down from the skies, gouging great scars across the face of our world, drying up the ancient oceans, and destroying the old civilization. But Lilrin, I protested, I would not dream of embarrassing you, much less of making any claim upon you for what I did. I was saving my own life as well as yours. Besides, you might have killed the Burok with one of your own bolts. You can't get out of it that way, she said with a wan little smile. It's the law. You saved my life. I belong to you. Ifs and maybes and perhapses don't count here on Mars. Well, I said, I can do with my property what I want, can't I? There's no reason why I can't give you back to yourself. Yes, there is. Because under the law, in a case like ours, it means what? I had to ask, knowing the answer in advance. Marriage. But I objected. Suppose I were already married. Then I would become your wife's slave, she explained unhappily. And if I were already married, both my husband and I would become your slaves. I didn't think much of that lore. It seemed to have too many disadvantages. Do you mean to say, I demanded, that if I were to save the life of your father, for instance, that he, the chief of your clan, would become my slave? Oh, yes, that is, unless it were in battle, when all lives already belonged to him anyway as commander-in-chief. In that event, you could establish no claim on him. But if you were to save my father's life as you saved mine just now, he, Mjarlur of the Tar Ennur, could never submit to the indignity of becoming a slave. But how could he help it? You say it is the law, and... He would kill himself, she said simply. Oh. For a long time we sat without speaking. I was trying to get a mental grasp on this strange Martian custom and the problem it involved. Lilrin sat dejectedly, gazing down the slope toward the undergrowth in which the dead Barak lay. Then there came to me a thought in which it seemed there might be a gleam of hope. I put it up to Lilrin. I know her. Therefore the laws of the Tar Ennur shouldn't apply to me, I argued. This would be true if Captain Hanley were on Earth. Travelers in a foreign country, while subject to the civil and criminal regulations in that country, are still citizens of their own state. As such, visitors cannot be forced into any kind of contract marriage if such is to their rights in their own nation. Foreign governments having diplomatic relations with other states all subscribe to international law or a set of customs which guarantees equal rights in commerce and the security of visiting citizens of another state. Yes, they do, she insisted. We're within the treaty boundaries of the Tar Ennur, and even though you are not one of us, you are subject to our laws. Well, I said in a clumsy attempt to comfort her, I guess you do things differently on Mars. Anyway, we'll find some way out of it, Lilrin. So, what's the matter? She asked in sudden anxiety, for my startled expression must have revealed something of the sudden fear that assailed me. You wouldn't think of getting out of it by killing myself? She smiled sadly. No, I don't want to kill myself. I want to live. Without warning, she burst into tears and then began to laugh hysterically. She jumped up and started to run back to the camp, then paused and returned slowly. You wouldn't run away, would you? She was pleading with me, because if you did, they'd cast me out as a deserted wife. Then she was gone, her slender little figure flashing in and out among the pale green stems of the forest as she ran back toward the camp. It was a crazy situation, all right, but no crazier than the fact that I was on Mars. I pinched myself hard and winced. No, this was all real enough. I gazed around at the pale yellow-green vegetation with its strange, unfamiliar forms. Low over the horizon hovered the sun, not half the size it should be to earthly eyes. Overhead, the strange tiny moons of Mars, moons only a few thousand miles distant and quite visible though it was broad daylight, hurled themselves across a cloudless sky with a speed that was visibly tremendous. Scarcely a thing on which my eye rested had any aspect of familiarity to me. Yet everything was vividly real. As to the girl, well, I didn't see what I could do about that. I sighed and bent my steps slowly back toward the camp of the Tar Ennur. By the time I got there, the entire clan was drawn up in military array. Lilrin, pathetically courageous, stood with her father several paces in front of the line. When she saw me, she said something to Mornir and stepped forward to meet me. We have to go through with it, Dinle, she murmured. Don't hate me too much. Don't worry, little one, I whispered. They make you my slave, or wife, whichever it is. But they can't make me treat you like a menial. You shall always be as free as you are now. And I gave her a little squeeze to reassure her. Your kindness makes me more your slave ever, she whispered in reply. Now come. She led me before her father. He read some formula rapidly from an inscription on a metal plate it looked like gold, which he took from a leather case slung over his shoulder. He spoke rapidly in some other tongue than that used normally by Tar Ennur, so I could not follow him at all. Then Lilrin bowed her head, and he placed my hand on her fair hair. Were there tears in her eyes? I wasn't sure. She kept her head averted from me. The simple ceremony was over in a few moments. The clansmen took it all very solemnly. They gathered in little groups as they walked away, and there were many curious glances thrown over shoulders at us. Marnia held out his hand to me, and I grasped it, earth fashion, but I could sense that there was no excess of warmth in him at the idea of Lilrin's marriage to me, an unknown and mysterious Outlander, for Marnia, of course, did not know my full story. Lilrin had not dared tell him, nor in all probability would he have believed it. He looked at me searchingly with troubled eyes. I stammered some promise to him that I would always consider Lilrin free, but I don't think his mind was on my words. He muttered a perfunctory benediction of some sort. Then he too turned and walked rapidly away, leaving us alone together in the center of the big square. Chapter 5, Honeymoon and Disaster. There were no festivities. Nobody seemed to be happy. Certainly Lilrin and I were not. We had gone through a meaningless formula, one that was acceptable to none of us. Yet there seemed to be nothing that could be done about it. Lilrin timidly interrupted my musing. "I shall get our supplies, Danan Le, if it pleases you." "And supplies?" I interrupted. "What for?" "We must leave the clan for 3 days," she explained. "Our wedding trip, you know."
"But look here, Lilrin," I objected. "That isn't going to mean a thing to us."
"I don't see why. We don't actually have to go, do we?" She nodded her head. "It is the custom. We won't need so very much. I'll be back with our supplies presently." I stood there frowning. The clansmen avoided me. I saw, too, that they avoided Lilrin. The newly wedded bride and groom were to be ignored, cast out, avoided for an arbitrary period of 3 days, it would I appear. Lilrin returned presently, laden with bags of food and weapons. Uncomfortably, I remembered the burrock. Strapped to her back was one of those light metal tent frames, and rolled and thrown across her shoulder was the tent itself. She staggered a bit under the burden. I hastened to her side, but she motioned me away.
"No, no, Danenle," she said.
"It is I who am the slave mate, not you. It is I who must carry the burden." "Nonsense," I began with some heat. "It is the law," she said simply. "It is I who will suffer if you do not let me obey it." I glanced quickly around. The clansmen were watching us intently. So I had to give it up. I shrugged my shoulders helplessly. Feeling meaner than I had ever felt in my life before, I followed Lilrin as she staggered through the triangular gate, away from the gleaming walls of the fortress-like edifice, off into the yellow-green forest. But once beyond sight, a single bound carried me to her side. Heedless of her protests, I took all of the burdens from her. To my earth muscles, the load was trifling. And now I laughed. "Where do we go from here? And why didn't you bring 2 tents? "Anywhere you say," she rejoined with the nearest thing to a smile since I killed the burrock, "and I shall sleep outside if you want me to."
"You'll do nothing of the sort," I muttered.
"I will." There were low hills a few miles beyond the canal, and we turned our steps in that direction. Lilrin had regained a bit of her gaiety, but was clearly ill at ease. We chatted in more or less desultory fashion as we went along. At a point somewhat higher up than that at which I had concealed my little spaceship, we prepared to cross the river. I thought with a little pang of my spacecraft. Perhaps Lilrin would like a ride in it. Why, I might even take her back to Earth with me. But no. It wouldn't be as though we were really in love with each other had really ever been married. So I left my thoughts to myself. We paused at the bank of the stream. All of a sudden, Lilrin gave a shriek of alarm. I looked at her quickly. I had a fleeting impression of her startled glance at something behind me, of a twanging noise from that direction. Something hit me with a tremendous blow on the back of the head, and I knew no more. I don't know how long it was before I revived. The pain in my head was terrific. Only by the most desperate effort of my will did I avoid slipping off into unconsciousness again. Little by little, I struggled to my knees and looked around me, fighting the nausea in my stomach. Lilrin was gone. So was all our baggage. There were marks in the soil as though a struggle had taken place. I staggered to my feet. My gun was gone from my thigh holster.
but I still have a little automatic inside my shirt. It was not hard to tell what had taken place. An abduction. I had been shot down from behind. Lilrin had struggled, but had been overcome and carried away. So hasty had been her kidnappers that they had not searched me thoroughly, which was certainly a break from my viewpoint. It stood to reason, of course, that Lilrin's abductors had not been members of her own clan. Who then were they? Members of a similar clan of nomads, or men of another race, from north of the barrier? Well, what to do? After a little of my strength came back, I got into action. My spaceship was under the water where I had left it, but the marauders apparently had found it, for one of the hatches and not that of the airlock had been opened. The sphere was filled with water. It would have to be dragged ashore and rolled over to be emptied. For a moment, I hesitated whether to return to the encampment and arouse the Tar-Enner or not, but it would mean further loss of precious time. So I didn't give that angle a second thought. And a moment later, my helplessness gave way to sudden excitement, for my desperately seeking eyes had caught marks on the bank of the stream, boat marks, as though a watercraft of some sort had been run up there. It was easy to see that the stream did not flow much farther in that direction. The presence of those boat marks indicated flight in the opposite direction. Away I went upstream along the canal valley in prodigious leaps of 15 feet and more. On Mars, Captain Hanley's weight would be one-third of normal, but the difference in gravity would not affect his muscular strength. Hence, on Mars, he would be 3 times as strong as on Earth. I was confident that my superiority over the Martians in speed, in strength, and in the weapon I still cuddled beneath my arm would enable me to overcome great odds. Time was the important element right now. At length, I came to the gap in the Great Quartz Barrier, where at some far distant age in the past the meteor, which had ploughed this canal scar in the face of the planet, had cut through. As yet, I had caught no glimpse of a water craft. A faint hail reached me from the glittering rocks above, and a figure stood forth, arm upraised. I recognized him as one of the Tar-Enner. I was up in the face of a jagged cliff, and at his side in a few moments. It was a young man named Aldor, on guard duty at the gap. A wheelboat, he told me, had gone downstream and returned, but he had seen no one in it except 4 northerners, with a crew of Duleels at the wheels. Still, he added, the forward deck was covered. Many people might have lain bound and gagged beneath that cover. It's not part of the Tar-Enner's duty, he went on, to interfere with the northerners themselves in their very rare passages back and forth through the gap. Our obligation, under our treaty with them, is simply to prevent migrations of the wild Julios. As I dropped back to the canal gap and leaped away toward the north, I saw Aldor racing madly back toward the encampment to pass on my alarm. North of the barrier, the character of the country changed somewhat. It was wild, but the vegetation was more prolific, and there were evidences here and there of ancient irrigation ditches laid out in regular rows. The canal itself was a shallow valley gouged across the face of a level plain. In its center, the stream had cut a deeper and less regular course. Several miles north of the barrier, I came upon the first evidence of habitation. It was a small structure, but built of that same iridescent material of which the fortress occupied by the Tar-Enner had been constructed. And like that mysterious edifice, it was a monolith, very old and worn. I redoubled my efforts and was passing the spot in mid-leap when a figure rose suddenly to contest my way. It was my first glimpse of a northerner. In the split second that elapsed before I hit him, my eye photographically registered a figure in flexible armor of yellow overlapping metal plates. There was a conical helmet that guarded the nose, ears, and neck as well as the head. Curved plates fitted over the shoulders, arm pieces cleverly overlapped at the elbows. Completing the outfit were a skirt or kilt on which more overlapping plates were fastened, and what might be described as metal boots hinged at the ankles. The fellow, in a panic of frantic haste, was trying to bring one of those long bowl-throwing tubes up at me. Evidently, my great leaps and speed completely upset his judgment of distance. My heavily shod foot came down on the tube, and we went crashing to the ground with a great clangor of metal. I was on my feet in an instant, but the Martian did not rise. There was a grotesque twist to his head. He had fallen, clumsily, and his neck was broken. His armor, I thought, might be useful to me as a disguise, and for an instant I considered appropriating it. But on second thought, I decided not to do so. It would be too awkward. I turned away and was about to leap on up the canal valley, which was becoming wider now, when I started back in surprise and alarm. Directly in my path was a mounted Martian, but it was the character of his steed that startled me. It was not a horse at all, but the only thing I could call it in any tongue of earth would be a dog. It was as large as a small horse and distinctly canine in appearance and in the intelligence of its eyes as it stood there, softly poised, watching me as intently as was its rider. The Martian was clad entirely in soft yellow leather, richly embroidered with sparkling beads. But his garb was not like that of the Tar Ennur. Instead of a loose, sleeveless shirt, he wore a sort of collarless, fitted jacket with long sleeves and a sash of scarlet leather. In place of the kilts, he wore tight-fitting leggings which covered his limbs entirely. He sat well forward on the back of his strange mount, with his toes hooked into peculiar stirrups just back of and under the animal's forelegs. The saddle was, in reality, a combination saddle and collar with a metal handle on the top of the latter part. There was no bridle. The rider evidently guided his mount by voiced commands, or possibly by pressure on the collar handle, though I judged the handle more to aid him in keeping his seat. Chapter 6. Intrigues of Gacko. For a moment we confronted each other, and in that brief spell I was conscious of a liking for the handsome young face before me. In it was nothing of fear, though this Martian knight had no weapon that I could see. But he sat watching me with a shrewd and alert interest. Then he raised his arms and held them wide, palms forward, in the Martian gesture of friendship. I glanced, uneasily, at the body of the dead guard. He noted it, too. "It is nothing," he said. "An accident. I saw it all. The fellow exceeded his duty in trying to stop you without first challenging." He paused a moment. "You are the mysterious guest of the Tar Ennur that Mornia was telling me about. I have never seen hair as dark as yours. What are you doing here? Are you Mornia's friend?" I asked softly, my hand slipping inside my shirt until it closed over the butt of the little automatic. I thought his eyes narrowed a bit at that, but he showed no alarm. "I am Mornir's friend," he declared flatly. "It was I who negotiated the treaty for the Tar Ennur, for the Council of Aloran, the greater lords of the polar cities. I was quite sure then that this lad had had no part in the abduction of Lilrin, and determined to take a chance on him. After all, I would need help of some sort in rescuing the girl. So I told him how I had been struck down, and of the wheelboat, as Eldor called it. His astonishment and indignation were obviously genuine. And just what were you about to do when we met?" he asked, giving me a curious look. "Follow that wheelboat and rescue Lilrin." He shook his head slowly in negative judgment. "You would not have had a chance," he said. "In the first place, you could not have overtaken it. I saw the speed at which you were leaping. I also saw the boat. In the second place, either Gacko, Alar of Gacalu, or one of his Epsom lesser lords was in charge of it. Then there were the Duelils at the wheels. They can fight, you know, and when handled by clever commanders, they are terrible adversaries. Oh, I know of the bowl thrower inside your garment, which your hand now rests on. I heard of that also from the Tar Ennur. But there were 50 Duelils in that boat, and I don't think you have that many bolts in your weapon." Discouragement must have shown in my face, for he laughed. "But it's not so hopeless as all that. A plan is taking shape in my mind. Gacko is no friend of mine, nor of Liani the Alarler, supreme lord of the cities. This abduction is surely Gacko's work. It is rumored that he has stolen girls from the southern clans before, that he has several of them among his wives." He smiled reassuringly. "Come with me. We must talk this over. We have, I think, a great opportunity to outwit Gacko. But what of Lilrin in the meantime?" I objected. "She will be all right. Gacko would not dare harm her until he had her safe within his power at home in Gacalu. Besides, he must hasten to attend a council of the Alarin to be held on the island in 2 days. I consented. There didn't seem to be much else for me to do. The young Martian, who informed me his name was Banner, and that he was one of the lesser lords of Bolin, the land adjacent to Gakalu on the Polar Sea, made me mount his dog steed behind him. At his command, the animal set off, leaping and scurrying up one of the ancient irrigation ditches away from the canal valley. Across a cultivated plain we scurried, between fields of melon-like plants, toward a range of low, verdure-clad hills. It took some skill to cling to the great dog's back, but so fast did he run that it was a matter of minutes only before we had plunged into the vegetation on the slope of the hills. The animal was now scrambling upward to where, in a clearing, stood one of those great iridescent monolithic fortresses such as that occupied by the Tar Inner. In through a triangular gate we flashed, and as the great dog came to a slithering stop, uttering a thunderous bark, a number of Dulios ran forward to take charge of him. It was the first chance I had had of seeing these near-human apes who serve the Northerners as slaves. Very manlike, they were in build and carriage, and covered from head to foot with yellow fur. But their eyes, so it seemed to me, did not shine with even as great intelligence as those of the dog steed. I mentioned this to Banner. "They are not as intelligent," he replied, "but they are more dependable when through several generations of captivity they have been trained to their tasks. But they have their limitations. These fellows, for instance, are of use only in the steed kennels. Those over there have been trained to till the fields. They are good for nothing else. These," pointing to several who were patrolling the walls, armed with spears, "are good soldiers, although quite incapable of acting on their own initiative. They can comprehend only a single military command at a time." "I see very few humans," I remarked. "No," he replied. "There are only a handful here, a few Ilden, that is to say, freemen and a dozen or so slaves. You see, this is merely an agricultural outpost, but its supervision comprises part of my duties, and I have to make periodic visits here." Banner insisted that I change from my earth clothes and put on a Martian suit, which he found for me among his stores. After that, we tarried at the post only long enough for refreshments. While we drank Lilquak, that invigorating beverage the Martians make from one of their varieties of giant melons, Banner explained to me something of the law which held together the northern cities. 7 lands bordered on the Polar Sea, ruled by 7 Alaren. One of these, Leoni, Alar of Haklan, was by election Alarler, or Supreme Lord of the Council of Alaren. Theoretically, the Alarin were as subject to the law as the Epsin, or lesser lords, and the Ildin, or freemen. But as a matter of fact, they enjoyed absolute power, for accusations could be brought against a Martian of the Polar Cities only by one of equal or superior rank. There were few of the Alarin who would not welcome the retirement of Gakko from among them, but none who would risk the precipitation of a general war. Ekalu, the land ruled over by Gakko, was one of the richest and most powerful of the Confederation, with strong natural barriers, a larger population of Ilden and slaves than any other land, and by far the greatest force of fighting-trained Dulios. Likewise, no other Alar was anxious to give Gakko any cause for offense that could be avoided. "But," Banner suggested thoughtfully, "I think that the man with a just complaint against this tyrant and the courage to slay or strip him of his power would not be regarded as an enemy. Not, at least, by the Alarler, the Supreme Lord, who fears Gakko's growing influence, nor the rulers of Bolin, Tuskaden, and Ilmo. The Alaren of Trilu and Yanadlu, the lands beyond Gakko's on the other side of the sea, are definitely his supporters. But I do not know that even they would necessarily feel injured by his elimination. Certainly it would be their best policy to cultivate the favor of the other Alaren in the event that Gakko were deposed or slain. Politics, it would seem, is the same on any planet with an intelligent population. It is not beyond the bounds of reason to suppose that the present crisis now facing Earth may not, at some time, have been duplicated in a remote planet." Banner paused uncomfortably. "Now, Doctor, I don't know whether you would resent being made use of in this way. You see, I am being perfectly frank with you. But you appear to be determined to fight Gakko single-handed anyhow. And, Well, I thought it might not be displeasing to you to know that you can count on a certain amount of secret help since your decision has already been made. Of course, if you fall into Gacko's hands, you must realize that Nolar could go very far in giving you protection. The whole situation is rather delicate. I'm sure you can understand our position, he added hastily. I grew thoughtful at this. I did not like the idea of plunging into the midst of the political turmoil in a world with which I was virtually unfamiliar, of being made a cat's paw by certain of its rulers. I had not leaped all this distance from the encampment of the Tar-Ener to become an assassin of Martian kings. I merely wanted to rescue Lilrin and punish the villains who had abducted her. Of course, you are under no obligation to accept any aid at all, Banner put in shrewdly. My only thought was that you want to rescue the girl, and... I'll do it, I said, jumping to my feet. Good, echoed Banner exuberantly. Come.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Story Hack Podcast. Make sure to check out Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3. So when average people are swallowed up in supernatural trouble, sometimes they have to stand against the darkness by themselves. These are their stories. Included in this volume are 12 new stories of regular people facing the worst the paranormal world has to offer. These heroes may not have powers, but they refuse to be powerless. You can find more information about Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3 at storyhack.com.